behind the news. Time check. It's 8 p.m. This is Radio Ghana.
A very good evening to you, and you are welcome to Behind the News, where you get the last word on the day's topical stories. My name is Agatha Samoa, and tonight, TUC picks up issue with the government over Ghana's over-reliance on economic policy advice from IMF and World Bank, saying the situation has made the country virtually live on imports. Civil society groups in Ghana want government to kick against the ECOWAS Commission's speedy process of meeting with chief negotiators in Brussels to sign the Economic Partnership Agreement. Demolition of houses at Ajayi-Kotoku. Residents dragged the Gawes Municipal Assembly to court to prevent the exercise from going on. And security experts speak on the decision by a group of armed robbers to demand money from residents of Agape, or the risk being robbed. Stay tuned for the next 1 hour as we bring you details of all these stories on our program tonight. You can also join the discussions via text on 0266-677570. 0266-677570. But first, Baba Yakubu is there with a summary of the day's news.
Thank you, Agatha. The Central Gonja District Police Command is investigating the case of a quack doctor, Ibrahim Dauda, who is alleged to have killed a middle-aged woman, Madame Atamini, at Makpeng, after administering drips on her at his chemical shop. Reports reaching Radio Ghana indicate that some motorists are resorting to panic buying following the recent frequent price increases. Investigations reveal that the intention of these drivers is to ensure that they are cushioned against price increases and shortages. A member of the National Biosafety Committee, Professor Robert Abedu, has stressed the need for the committee to intensify its public education and stakeholder consultations on genetically modified organisms and biotechnology because of the tension it is creating in the country. The National Communications Authority has unveiled standards for radio and telecom terminal equipment. The new guideline, called Typed Approval, is to introduce variety of equipment choice for the consumer and also maintain consumer rights of the quality and safety of the equipment. And the African Union of Broadcasting has called for a concerted effort to reverse the situation whereby intermediaries own sporting rights and resort to blackmailing member states. The Director General of GBC, Major Albert Donchebe, who led Ghana's delegation to the 7th General Assembly of the Union at Yaoundé, Cameroon, disclosed this in an interview with Radio Ghana.
Live on Radio Ghana. Our crowd text line again is 0266-677570. In the last 3 decades, our economic policy have been heavily neoliberal in character, privatization of strategic national assets, unbridled liberalization of international trade, and the ruthless deployment of market forces, as evidenced by the removal of subsidies on utilities and fuel. These bad economic policy choices have been exacerbated by pervasive corruption, cronyism, incompetence, and extreme partisanship. These are quotes from a statement by the TUC on the state of the economy. The TUC holds the view that economic and social challenges facing Ghana are rooted in the nature of economic policies and the failure on the part of leadership to do the right things for the country. And we'll be speaking with the Secretary General of the TUC, Kofi Asamoah, on the general economic situation in Ghana. Good evening, sir. You're welcome to the program.
Good evening, madam.
Well, Mr. Asamoah, you said managers of the economy have chosen to ignore the advice of the TUC and rely on that advice of experts of the IMF and the World Bank, saying these bad economic policy choices have been exacerbated by pervasive corruption, cronyism, incompetence, and extreme partisanship. Will these words make it possible for the managers of the economy to want to dialogue with you on what alternatives you have on improving the economy?
So generally, it's an assessment we are making on the economy. And if you read our statement well, we are not only referring to this government alone, but then the economic policies pursued the past 30 years, the new liberal policies that have been pursued over the past 30 years is what we are really talking about. And indeed, these neoliberal policies that you read and the kind of things they do has not succeeded in changing the fundamentals of the economy. So in effect, our point is driving home that neoliberal policies, which are normally pushed on our throats by the IMF World Bank, has succeeded not in bringing any significant impact in our lives. Instead, they just talked about opening your doors widely, trade liberalization, bringing in everything that you can talk about. And where you import almost everything and export very little, and even in the little, in a raw state, it doesn't bring about any significant growth in our economy. So the assessment is over the last 3 decades. And I think the issues have been the same. The vehicle has been the same, except the drivers that have been changing. And the symptoms are what we are really making it known to you in our state.
And you are also saying that government and its agencies are not effectively managing the oil resources. Is that the case?
Yes, we have a public institution set up. It's called a PIAC. And the PIAC really brought the report out. We are represented on the PIAC. And the report that came out of the management of the resources of the oil production that we've made has not been the best. It has been an assessment we did, and some of the projects where these monies were expended on, have not been accounted appropriately for. So if you get the PIAC report, the PIAC is a body set up to really ensure that there is an efficient management of the oil resources. I brought about a report. We did that, and that is exactly what we quoted.
Well, in your statement, you said that you hold the view that the economic and social challenges that we face as a country are rooted in the nature of economic policies and the manner in which we have chosen to conduct national affairs, and the economic woes we are facing can be attributed to the hands of neoliberal economic policies and failure on the part of leadership to do the right things for the country. So what exactly does the TUC want the leadership to do?
You see, we really draw in a point to an economic policy which seeks to rely on some specific indicators. It talks about growth that does not lead to development. And all these policies over the years that we pursued it, this is not the first time. If you follow the statements we've rarely stated in the past, we're saying that the real structure of the economy is not changing. The fundamentals of the economy is not changing. And we are treating the symptoms. We know that these challenges have short-term responses and long-term responses. Until we really hold the bull by the horn and begin to ensure that the real productive aspect of our country works, we'll be galloping from one problem to the other. All these things are known to our economic management and policy makers. Over the years, we've been talking about it, but it doesn't. It just talked about opening your doors. We are importing more than we are exporting. We are exporting our raw materials. And all these things does not really lay credence to creation of jobs and impacting on the lives of our people. So our assessment of the economy is based on what we've been saying all along, that until the structure of the economy changes and until the fundamentals of the economy changes, we'll gallop from one problem to the other. The situation has been worsened by the decline of the CD over the period. And in some of these policies, what it does is to ask for the removal of subsidies. It asks for privatization. All these things have been done in the past, and yet we seem not to find our way. The city decline is such that it is only the, how do we call it, the aspect of the economy which really allows for various investors entering. There are no checks and balances. So we are even told that the service sector, people change monies in, change their profits into, or the money they generate into dollars and carry them in sacks away almost every day without any checks and balances. So if we go ahead with these things, we will not do anything good. No country, no developing country has succeeded in becoming a seller's economy. We all know this, but we keep on still listening to the IMF, World Bank on these kind of economic policies, and we keep on galloping from one problem to the other. The main thrust of our statement is to bring to the fore that times are really hard. With the introduction of taxes, levies, increase in VAT, road, transport fares, increase in fuel, through the automatic adjustment system. We agree to the automatic adjustment system, but if you don't control the economic indicators, it will definitely be very precarious. It will be very dangerous for us. So as a result, it's not only the exchange rate decline that is going on. As a result, prices of goods and services are going up, rent and other cost of things are going up, yet salaries are fixed annually. And indeed, we're drawing home to the fact that there's a limit to which working people can contain if we do not quickly, as quickly as possible, review the national minimum wage and the base pay and ensure that some monies are put in workers corresponding with the increases, then it is very, it's going to be very disastrous. So the thrust of our statement is to draw government's attention to the high increases, and we're saying that we cannot contain it anymore. And if you read the statement well, we are asking for the reconvening of the National Tripartite Committee, although some processes have started already, to as quickly as possible see to improving incomes in the country. Otherwise, we can't contain the hardships arising.
Well, we will come back to the base pay and the relativity on the single spine solution. But talking about the taxes, was the TUC not involved in negotiating some of these taxes?
No, I think the level that we were involved, for instance, in the area of utility, our involvement was from the fact that one, you do not wait for so many years and then bring a huge increase at a go. That is the level of our involvement. We consider to the automatic adjustment formula because we don't want to wait for so long before the increases come. If the increases are gradual, it can be contained. But then if the economic indicators are not managed well, for instance, the way there is a decline in the city, if it continues, then it means then that almost every week this automatic thing will have to come, or every within a shortest time, increases like we have seen in the level of fuel and the things would not really augur well. Yes, we agree to the automatic adjustment with the proviso and the understanding that the economic indicators will be managed well. If it's not managed well and the way we see it and the increases that has come arising out of fuel, for instance, from the beginning of the year, it is really cannot be contained.
So are you saying that the economic indicators are not being managed well, so to speak?
Yes, the, for instance, the decline in the currency, the rate at which the city is declining, is a particular example. If it continues going that way, it means that it will undermine the objectives of the automatic adjustment formula, and we can't contain repeated increases in that level. Perhaps then what we are calling in the statement is to bring back the subsidies, because we cannot go ahead in that way, particularly because salaries are also not automatic adjusted. Salaries are just for 1 year. So if the managers of the economy don't see to check those indicators that reflect on the policy or the automatic adjustment, of course, then it becomes unbearable. And that is why we're drawing government's attention to the fact that we need to, as quickly as possible, do something to incomes. Otherwise, we can't continue.
Well, Ms. Asama, I indulge you to hold the line for me. We also have joining the discussions James Kluche Aveju, who is the chairman of the Finance Committee of Parliament. Good evening, Mr. Aveju, and you are welcome to the program.
Good evening, and good evening to your listeners.
Well, I'm sure you heard Mr. Asama there on the economy, but the TUC is calling for a radical overhaul of economic and social policies because they believe our economic challenges are rooted in the nature of our economic policies. And they say these bad economic policy choices have been exacerbated by pervasive corruption, cronyism, incompetence, and extreme partisanship.
Well, thank you very much. Good evening, Mr. Samoa. First of all, I don't want to see this statement as a political statement. I want to see it as a statement coming from a TUC and looking at the time frame that he made reference to, about 3 decades, it cut across a number of governments, which means that as a country, we have come to a point that we all need to look at how we can manage our economy to the benefit of the people. I read through the statement. I disagree with some of the issues that was raised in the statement. And I also agree with some of the issues that were raised. And I think that the call for us having a national dialogue on how to manage the economy, I support it 100%. In fact, if that dialogue is held, we will then appreciate and understand what really goes into these issues and how we can move as a country. In that case, we'll do away with politics, and therefore, if the government of the day is introducing a policy, that policy will be accepted by all. So I fully 100% support the call for having a national dialogue on the way forward in managing our economy. Now, Mr. Samo, the statement talk about a lot of issues, what is happening now. And there are issues that were also left out completely in the statement. And he went ahead to provide some short-term and then long-term measures. If I go through, I should go through with some of the short-term and then long-term measures. The statement is talking about government rollback on taxes and new charges, fees and charges that government impose on the people. What I want us to all understand is that I do not think that any government will be so cruel that that government will want to impose taxes on the people. If that government does not need the revenue. So if the government is imposing taxes, it means that government wants revenue to meet expenditure. If you look at the 2014 budget statement, which I believe Mr. Samoa will have a copy, the total revenue that we are going to raise as a country is 26 billion Ghana cedis. Despite the new taxes that have been raised, the VAT that the statement talk about, the new fees and charges, all put together, we are raising a total of 26 billion Ghana cedis as a nation, which is not even a budget of State University of New York. The budget of State University of New York is more than the 26 billion Ghana cedis that we have as a country. But if you look at the expenditure to which we are going to apply this revenue, in for example, if we're able to generate all the 2020 billion, the total expenditure we need to incur as a country is 35.9 billion, almost 36 billion. There's a gap of all about 30 billion Ghana cedis. So how does government in the first place even meet that difference? It's a different issue. That is why we talk about budget deficit all the time. It means that government must go and borrow money in order to meet that difference. So we have a challenge from day one as a country. So government is not comfortable when government wants to impose taxes on the people, when government wants to do away with subsidy, because subsidy, in a way, is an additional expenditure to government. So government is doing all this in order to balance the budget, in order to ensure that the expenditure is spread across board, people pay, and as well as people contribute through their taxes. Now, another measure, medium-term, no, short-term measure that the statement talk about is to rid of corruption and corrupt elements. I do not think that government has sat down unconcerned if issue about corruption is being mentioned. The difficulty here is how to identify this and then have a concrete evidence and take action against them. Those that you have evidence, action is being taken against them. And so, but if there's a corruption that is going under the carpet that you don't see it, it will be difficult for government to do that. So I think that the call here is for all of us as a nation, that what do we do to do away with all this corrupt element.
But you agree with him that times are really hard.
Yeah, I do. I'm saying that the times are not really hard for only the citizens. The times are hard for even government. Because if you look at the numbers I've given you, total revenue for the year is $26 billion. Total expenditure for the same year is $36 billion. A difference of $10 billion. Where government get that money from? What is the source of revenue to government? Government, the major source of revenue to government is taxes that we pay back ourselves, individuals, companies, direct taxes and indirect taxes and the rest, and other items that we have. So that is the reality. Now, if you come to the long-term measure that the statement is talking about, it's talking about a radical overhaul of economic and social policy, which is definitely warranted. I agree with that. That if you want to have a radical overhaul of the system, a lot of issues have been mentioned here, which I agree with the statement fully in the area of promotion of domestic or some basic necessities of this country. The country has come to a point that we are import-led economy. Once you're import-led economy, you will definitely have pressure on your currency because the demand for the foreign currency is more than the supply of that currency.
In that case, how do we tackle the appetite for imports?
Yeah, that is why I agree with the statement that we need to avoid total import-led economy. How do we do that? We need to provide or produce some of the basic things that we need as a country here in the domestic market. We need to promote the local industry. We need to discourage import through some kind of import levies, import duties that can make the import difficult for the people.
All right.
Then we also need to work on our own self as people, our attitude, and how do we appreciate our locally made goods.
All right. Mr. Vedi,
that is why I agree with the statement in that respect.
I'll come back to you, but Mr. Sama, you heard explanations Mr. Vedi has been given, and you want an upward adjustment of wages to cushion workers from the current economic hardship, but can government afford that?
Let me begin by saying that I also share the issues that he raised, and that is exactly what we are trying to indirectly bring out. He very much shared the point. Yes, in as much as government revenue is small, I think he also appreciates that there is a limit to which working people or all those who earn income can also meet the cost of living, as it were. So, yes, we need to also look for a long-term way in solving this. We cannot do all those things overnight. But then it's also important that we block all leakages, so that when it comes to all of us tightening our belts, we tighten our belts and do that. And that is why the footnote of our statement is calling for a dialogue. Because, you see, the way we politicize discussions in this country is not helping anybody. So if we get into a dialogue where we do so without political lenses, then look at the real challenges facing us. As I recall, these challenges has been there for the past 30 years. It is the vehicle that has been changing. The vehicle has been the same. It's the drivers that we change along. So if we all concede to looking at the fundamentals, the real structure of the economy, then I think we are on the same wavelength and we should be working towards that. One major issue is where there is improvement in the service sector of the economy. And there are most people in the service sector, our currency policies are not being really enforced. So we are told that people generate so much, particularly in the service sector, the telephonic companies, they change money into dollars and carry it almost every day away. So yes, from the Honorable's responses, it seems that we all share the view, and indeed we needed to ensure that we get a forum that is devoid of political lenses. Then we look at what do we do to salvage our economy.
Very well. Mr. Asamoah, I want to thank you for your time with us. Kofi Asamoah is the Secretary General of the TUC. And Mr. Aveji, can government meet workers' demand for wage adjustment?
If the Tripartite Committee meets and the numbers are put on the table, what I want to say is that we just want to appeal to the committee members, especially the workers, to sympathize with government and then come out and then accept whatever proposal government will be coming out with, because it is being done in the general interest of all of us. If we continue, we said we the workers want our pay all the time to increase. If that will lead to the distortion in the economy and therefore for us to be having all these difficulties, then it means that future is not good for us. So government is here to help all of us to see how we can move forward for the sustainability of the economy and how we can improve upon the economy. So I think that the committee will discuss the issues and then come up with the right position.
We are grateful for your time with us tonight, James. Aveji is the chairman of the Finance Committee of Parliament. It's Behind the News live on Radio Ghana Accra. The news is also live on Unique FM 95.7 in Accra, Radio Savannah 91.2 in Tamale, Garden City Radio 92.1 in Kumasi, and Twin City 94.7 in Takoradi. Civil society groups are raising the red flag over the sudden change in ECOWAS decision to reverse its position on the demands by the EU under the Economic Partnership Agreement EPA negotiations. To tell us what is wrong with the agreement is Sylvester Bagru of the Third World Network. Good evening, Sylvester, and you're welcome to the program.
Good evening.
Well, Sylvester, why are you worried about the Economic Partnership Agreement negotiations and ECOWAS position?
There are a number of issues wrong with the process. That is how the ECOWAS all of a sudden, defend to make a lot of concessions to the European Union. That's one. So there's a problem with the process. There's also a problem with the content. In terms of the process, the ECOWAS Commission, they made a number of arguments over the years that, look, we cannot concede to the EU on a number of issues. And all of a sudden, within this month, they have turned around and they've actually neglected the technical experts, and then the whole trade agreement is now between the diplomats, what I call the senior officials, who have no technical knowledge in the area of trade and investment. That's one. In terms of the content, the ECOWAS Commission, they've agreed with the European partners to open up the manufacturing sector. We are opening up to about 75% market access. And so they've actually agreed to sacrifice the manufacturing sector, which is the heart of industrialization in West Africa, just to have an agreement with the EU. Then the second thing is that they've also agreed with the European Union that in case we have any future trade agreement with any third party, then the EU automatically qualifies if it offers better terms. So, for instance, if tomorrow we want to enter an agreement with Brazil or China or India, and it offers better concessions, then the EU automatically qualifies. This means that technically, the whole of Europe is a member of ECOWAS. Thirdly, we also have revenue that we collect when we import goods into our sub-region. And so, from the UN Economic Commission for Africa, we are going to lose about $1.8 billion. The dollars. That's what we're going to lose as a region. Then, in the case of Ghana, we're going to lose annually about $300 million dollars. And so these are revenues that we control and we have. And so we are going to forgo these in return of a promise, because the European Union is promising us, they are going to give us about 6.5 million, a billion euros for the whole region over 5-year period. And so when you divide that, even what you get in terms of the promised aid is less than the revenue that you have. And so for a rational point of view, the best thing to do is control your resources. The worst of all the agreement is when they indicate that, look, we are going into other areas, that Nigeria, what they call into the area of government procurement, investment, and the competition. All right, let me talk about the government procurement. Government procurement in the sense that if there's any contract, the government of Ghana cannot discriminate in favor of a local company. And so the European companies, they also have the same right to bid for any contract that, as a country that we have. And so we lose that sovereignty we have as a country to determine which area we need to direct government expenditure into. So that we lose that if we sign on to this agreement.
So, Versa, are you saying that the ECOWAS is rushing with this agreement?
You see, you enter into an agreement based on the strategy. The EU, over the years, have come to the certainty that, look, their survival in the coming years depends on, one, raw materials, and two, markets. You know, basically, that's their strategy. And so they are coming out looking for markets across Africa for raw materials to feed into the industries in Europe. You have no strategy. So tell me, within ECOWAS, we don't have any strategy of industrialization. You don't have any strategy of Ghana, for instance. So where are we going as a country in the mess in which we found ourselves? And so if you're in this situation, the best thing you need to do is, one, to look at your strategy and see how you can actually advance the economies in West Africa. And for you to sacrifice the future development and current development of the whole region because European Union is promising aid. Not even with uncertainty, you know. And so you agree onto this agreement. I think it doesn't make any economic sense.
So when ECOWAS goes ahead, what options are open to you to try to have the process halted altogether?
You see, ECOWAS cannot determine for the member states. So once ECOWAS can go ahead, if they go and they still go ahead to sign the agreement, one, the Parliament of Ghana will have to ratify the agreement to make it legal. And so the government of Ghana, they have the chance to tell Parliament not to ratify the agreement. That's one. Those that have an opportunity to tell the negotiators, or the ministers are meeting on the 17th of February, to tell them not to object to such an agreement. Because the agreement they advanced 10 years ago, one, you cannot enter into an agreement where your partner, they don't have energy problem, they don't have water problem, they don't have infrastructure, other hard infrastructure and soft infrastructure, they don't have those problems. If it comes to Ghana, every 3 months we complain of energy problems. And so if you start a company today, the odds against you, they get too many. And so you cannot compete meaningfully with companies that are supported in terms of infrastructure and all that, with subsidies and all that. You cannot just compete. So you just wipe up the local companies. And so the government has an opportunity to redeem itself from this kind of mess that you were ending to. And the last point is that, you see, we have alternative, clear alternative for as a country, and we are not following them.
Well, Sylvester, you said for the first time the EPA process will not exclude the technical experts, civil society, and the private sector in the region. Are you raising the issues because civil society groups are being excluded from this?
You see, the meeting in Senegal, the technical expert disagreed with the European Union on all these issues. So that's one. Now, when the experts finished, the senior officials came and they brushed aside the technical experts. And so you can see the process. The technical experts said, look, we cannot agree to a situation where we sacrifice our massage sector. That comes from ECOWAS experts, I mean the technical experts. We cannot agree to the most relevant clause, I mean the clause that ties us to a situation where we cannot have any trade agreement again. And so these are issues that the technical experts said, look, we cannot go into that. And you have the senior officer overriding that. And all, that's why we are talking about that process. All of a sudden, they've agreed on these issues. I mean, that's important. But the reality is there. If you think that you can sacrifice your manufacturing sector, you got a manufacturing sector, because of European Union promising aid, I think it raises a lot of questions. Coming to civil society, look, civil society, we've actually done a number of studies, right from the UN Economic Commission for Africa, the African Union. They've done a lot of studies just to make sure that, look, we get our development, the fundamentals right in terms of development. That's the concern of the experts, concern of the civil society, concern of the private sector, all that. If you don't get those things right, I mean, things keep on getting worse in the country. You have unemployment.
Master Vasta, you agree that we also don't have a strong manufacturing base. That's why we are going to this partnership.
Yeah, so if you don't have a strong manufacturing base, why do you open up for European goods to flood your market? I'll give you one example. And so if you take, let's say, pharmaceuticals, we have a lot of local companies that produce pharmaceuticals. And the region, the market is Ghana and the ECOWAS region. Once you open up, so you have a lot of European companies coming to take over that. So how will they compete? Take another company, these insecticides and these light manufacturers. Their market is West Africa. It's not Europe. And so if you open up prematurely, then all that you have, these companies that are supported, they come and take control of your market. And so that's key. No country in the world has ever developed without protecting its domestic sector. I mean, no country, apart from Hong Kong, China. These are the only countries. So no country in the world has ever developed. And so if, as a country, we think that we cannot protect our local manufacturers. We cannot protect our local producers and open them up for competition. I think we are wrong fundamentally.
Sylvester, I want to thank you for your time with us. Sylvester Bagro is with the Third World Network. It's Behind the News live on Radio Ghana Accra. Behind the News live on Radio Ghana Accra. Behind the News is also live on Radio Central 92.5 in Cape Coast, Sunrise FM 106.7 in Kofodia, Radio BAR 93.5 in Sunyani, Radio Upper West 90.1 in Wa. Government does not own any land at Ajinkotoku. These are sentiments expressed by residents in the community located in the West municipality of Greater Accra. Their reaction comes after government warned to carry out the demolition of illegal structures at Ajinkotoku to relocate residents of Sodom and Gomorrah in Accra. So at what stage is this issue? Speak to some of the people involved. But joining us on the line is Joseph Fankiwu, spokesperson of the Residents Association. Good evening, Joseph, and you're welcome to the program.
Good evening, my sister, and good evening to your cherished listeners.
Joseph, what are your reasons for claiming that government does not own land at Ajinkotoku?
My sister, I believe you are privy to the fact that this case has gone to court, and indeed, we've put out a lawyer's number for you to speak with him. So I will not be able to try to adduce our reasons for claiming that the government does not own the land. But then all that I can tell you is that the feeling of my group right now is not very good. The feeling is one of despondence, and we are just saying that the government of Ghana should be so much concerned about the plight of its citizens. The government should not be the one to be seen to be trying to displace citizens. And that is our issue right now.
But you have you regularized the lands you acquired at the local assembly?
That is what I said to you earlier, my sister. These are all details that borders on legality, and I think that we are leaving that to our lawyer to argue it out in court when he clashes with the respondent's lawyers.
All right, Joseph, we want to thank you for your time with us. Joseph Fankibi, spokesperson of the Residents Association, and Amufa Ajiman is lawyer for residents of Ajinkotoku, and he's joining us on the line. Good evening, Mr. Ajiman. You are welcome to the program.
Good evening.
And we understand that this issue has been sent to court. What are you praying the courts to do for the residents?
My sister, let me thank you for the opportunity to speak on this matter. I just want to caution that since, as you already know, the matter is in court, I do not intend to have the matter tried on radio. and therefore we may not want to go into the details. But suffice it to say that it is true, we have gone to court and we are praying the court to restrain the assembly and whoever is working on the assembly from demolishing the structures of our client. And we think that we have a good case.
In which court are you pursuing the case in?
The High Court. Okay.
All right, and when will the case be heard?
We've just filed the writ, and I understand the writ has been served on the defendant. We are also seeking some interim orders, including interlocutory injunction. And therefore, that may be coming out, I guess, on the 12th of this month. And therefore, we will be waiting until that time to have your case in court.
All right, Mr. Ajima, I want to thank you for your time with us tonight. Amufa Ajima is lawyer for the residents of Ajin Kotoku. It's Behind the News, live on Radio Ghana Accra. Live on Radio Ghana. Let's go back to our story on Ajin Kotoku and Sam Atu Koi is the municipal chief executive of Gao West, and he's joining us on the line. Good evening, Sam, and you are welcome to the program.
Yeah, good evening. Thank you.
Well, Sam, at what stage is government's plan to carry out demolition at Ajin Kotoku?
Hello?
Yeah. Could you reposition yourself? You're having a feedback from your end.
I'm actually in the car. We are going. I'm not going home.
All right. Yes, it's much better. Go ahead.
Okay. As you know, government plan, making Kotoku an economic hub by decongesting business activities in Nakukushi and Sodom and Gomorrah, as plans to do the subsidized government was in a discussion with the chiefs of Kotoku. And about 233 acres of land is in discussion to be acquired. And compensation is almost ready. It's ready to be given to the chiefs and people who will be affected. And unfortunately, there was no understanding regarding especially those who bought some of the land, because some of them did not buy from the rightful owners. Some bought from other family members because they are litigating. Others bought from landowners. Others bought from youth who are always trespass on the land. And therefore, there was some misunderstanding. Government now, or if you like, we don't want to continue to have the kind of banter that we saw last week, and so we have decided to engage all stakeholders so that we can all think from the same message to ensure that the project moves on smoothly. And so the 28th February date that was slated for the project to be commissioned, we have suspended that date so that we'll be able to meet all the stakeholders and bring everybody to understand the government's position on this and how this is going to even help some of the residents to, alleviate poverty and create jobs and all of that. So we are not ready to make people feel as if government is insensitive. And so I think the right or the surest way forward is to engage and negotiate. So that is the stage where we are. Unfortunately, today, some of the residents, not residents, some of the landowners who are at various stages of developing the land have decided to go to court. So they have taken the chief, that is the landowners, to court, and then they have also joined the assembly in the court suit. And so we are also ready to pursue the matter in court as well as to negotiate probably out of court. So that is where we are.
So for now, let's say there's not going to be any demolition.
No, even before today that we received the transfer, I indicated to all of them that we are willing to suspend the demolition so that we will listen to everybody and make people feel how the law works and how people will be affected, will be assured that they are going to be compensated. So we suspended that until today. We decided to go to court. The demolition exercise has been suspended.
Well, Sam, the people insist that government does not own the land, but can you give us a brief history as to how government acquired the said land?
Okay, the land in question is not a state land. The land in question belongs to the chief of one of the chiefs in Kotoko. His name is Nitaki Abwa. And somewhere around 2004, 2005, President before, as part of plans to decongest Abu Ghusheng, Sodom and Gomorrah, decided to enter into a memorandum of understanding to the chiefs to compensate and the chiefs by acquiring, I think the original land size was about 1,900 acres. But as I speak to you now, an agreement was reached for 233 acres thereabouts, 203 acres thereabouts, to be used for the project, the market development as it could be. Now, everything went well to the extent that some people who had built little structures, at that time it was bush, a lot, it was bush. At the time, some people have also developed some small structures, so they were compensated on the structure, living compensation on the land. And so, just when government at the time was about to release money, then conflict emerged between other chiefs claiming ownership of that same land. Until recently, when it was resolved that the chief, the land belongs to Miyamwa, then government, who is also ready to compensate among the chiefs, among the chiefs and the family, they also started having agreements where the money to be lodged. And who should also be compensated? When had a competition, she was ready.
All right. So, Sam, when... Well, it's unfortunate we lost Sam Atukwe on the line. Sam Atukwe is the municipal chief executive of GA West. It's Behind the News live on Radio Ghana Accra. The 1992 Constitution of Ghana guarantees the fundamental human rights of the ordinary citizen, including the freedom of association to promote an interest. However, these rights and freedoms come not without limitations. Can you imagine a group of criminals coming together to form an association to protect their interest? A gang of robbers calling itself Armed Robbers Association is reported to have dared the state and pasted notice demanding money from the residents of Agapeni Accra, threatening the lives of the people. The robbers had demanded 500 cedis from each household and were bold to urge the residents to send the money to an MTN mobile money number they had provided or risk being robbed. The incident is said to have all started in December last year when the residents woke up to find the notices posted on their gates, walls, electricity and other places threatening them to pay the money through the MTN mobile account. And joining us on the line now is DSP Freeman Tete, who is with the Public Affairs Directorate of the Ghana Police Service, to tell us the latest on this. Good evening, DSP, and you're welcome to the program.
Good evening, my sister, and good evening to your cherished listeners.
Can you update us on this situation? Any arrests made so far?
Yes, one person was arrested over the weekend and is in our custody. He's one of the masterminds of this notices pasted. But the ringleader itself, we are still close enough to him. We It was our wish that this information does not come to public attention because it's an intelligence that we are gathering. Unfortunately, it came out today, so we have to still comment on it and also assure the public that we are firmly on the ground, particularly those living at Agape. Because one person has been gotten, but there are still a lot more there out there that we have to narrow on. And that is why when we had the information, we decided to keep it to ourselves and work behind the scene and also work with the resident so that at the end of the day, we will arrive at a definite conclusion. We have to solve this.
What security tidbits should the residents arm themselves with?
Well, the state is there to provide security, and the police represent the state when it comes to providing internal security. So we have to be on the ground, and we are indeed firmly on the ground. Patrols right from the national SWAT unit, the regional SWAT unit, and the district. These structures are already existing in every part of Accra. But because of the peculiar nature of the situation at Agape, security has been beefed up. The various units, operational units, have their wings there, being coordinated by the district commander at the place. We have the plain cloth as well as the uniformed police personnel on the ground, day and night patrols. And it's not only that, we have the intelligence unit on the ground as well. Besides that, the normal CID is also active on the ground. We have to do everything possible to ensure that their threat is not manifested. Besides that, we have to discourage that in every part of this country. Criminal cannot overwhelm us. We are determined to bust any criminal gang that suffers. They have gone too far because this is the first time that even though occasionally criminals do peace notices informing some household that they will be coming. But this is the first time that we've seen or heard anything of this nature. So we have to be serious with it so that it does not become a normal thing for criminals.
So how then...
Because it's an illegality, even though your preamble was the 19, you make reference to freedom of association.
Yeah.
But this is an illegality, for sure. It will never be tolerated in any serious country.
So how do individuals get information to the police on the ground?
Surely, our emergency lines are there. The various police commanders are on the ground. That they can be accessed. Besides that, we have the short code. The 18555.
Very well.
For Vodafone and MTN only. Toll free. Then the 191 for all network. Just access the police information room. Give a tip off to the police. Don't keep information to yourself because at the end of the day, even if you are well protected, your brother, your siblings, your friends, your church members are prone to danger. So, assist the police to provide adequate security for everybody.
All right. DSP, we want to thank you for your time with us. DSP Freeman Tetesu, the Public Affairs Directorate of the Ghana Police Service. And what do security experts make of the incident at Agape? Dr. Ken Ahosu is a research fellow at the Legon Center for International Affairs and Diplomacy, and he's joining us on the line. Good evening, Doc, and you're welcome to the program.
Good evening.
Well, Doc, we've had reports of series of armed robberies in our neighborhoods and on the highways, but what do you make of the boldness by a group of armed robbers demanding money from the residents of Agape?
Well, I think it's rather surprising because I think the police and the other security agents are doing quite well. And apart from the cases that have been reported of late, there's not been a spate. But for them to come boldly, what it suggests to me is that the people know the environment very well. And I believe that they are, in fact, living in the environment or living in the surrounding, they know their way in and out very well. That is how they could come up with such a serious kind of information or demand upon the people. This said, I think that the criminals are very, very kind of unwise. in the sense that technology has moved to a point that I don't know. I was speaking earlier somewhere and I said these sort of things are not supposed to be said on air. But I expect the police by now that the number that they give for the MTN money transfer, the police have a right to go to court and then have a warrant and go to the provider and find out who is the owner of this number. It's most likely that they are using somebody, either a girlfriend or somebody's number, because they would not be so careless to use their own number. But then I expect the police not just to beef up the security in the area, but as they rightly pointed out, their intelligence is on the ground. They should be a step ahead and find out who this number belongs to. Even if the person is, his identity is just being used, they must do investigation around it. Why this is important is that if they are able to carry out preemptive arrest, then lives will be better protected, because should these people attack and the police are present, sometimes somebody may be shot or somebody may be killed in the process as they panic to run away. So as the criminals have provided this link, I expect them to go to the extra length. They should go further and then try to preemptively arrest these people by getting the valid intelligence that is necessary to preempt the situation.
And what do you think the residents can also do to protect themselves? Because even though the police have assured them of their safety, they are still living in fear.
Well, there are normal things that all along we've been told. For example, there should be whistles, alarms, and that sort of thing. That when somebody is attacked, you can raise this alarm so that the rest know that the attack is going on for that matter. And at the same time, people should make sure that their doors are properly locked. They have burglar proofs. Those who can afford should have burglar proofs. And then they should keep each other's phone and numbers and that sort of thing. So when somebody is calling, they know that this person is calling. Personally, I would not advise that ordinary citizens arm themselves. Because sometimes in the use of these arms, they misuse the arms, and either when they are not professional, they hurt each other or make the situation worse. So I would just feel that the normal security precautions that they are taught, everybody is taught to take, they must take these precautions. And then they shouldn't stay out very late in the night, like going out and coming back 1 a.m., 2 a.m., and that sort of thing, because the trend is that most of the time these armed robbers follow people who come home so late, and once you open your gate or your door, they jump on. You know, the danger is that the security cannot be everywhere. The police cannot be everywhere. And sometimes to fire a gun or to stab somebody just takes, a split second. So for me, that is my concern. So people should take other forms of precaution, come back from work on time when it's possible, and even if they are late, sometimes they must inform the police that they are coming this late to this particular house, and for that matter. So I think it is not a situation which is out of hand, and I hope that these people are arrested before they cause any mayhem.
Doc, we want to thank you for your time with us tonight. Dr. Ken Ahosu is a research fellow at the Legon Center for International Affairs and Diplomacy. This is where we wrap up for tonight's edition of the program. Isaac Yawedu controlled the sounds, and my producers were Christopher Sidu, Brian Tagama, John Poby, and Celestine Avi. Barbara Yakubu read the summaries. My name is Agatha Samoa, and you have a lovely night.